7.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In government, the rubber stamp marked confidential gets a lot of use. Bureaucrats happily mark their documents secret or top secret without a second thought. Science is supposed to be different. In a world where the research of one team is essential in the conclusions of another, access and openness are supposed to be the rule. But now all the talk of biological weapons, anthrax and smallpox is changing these rules, so much so that the editors of America's leading science journals have decided that a form of self-censorship may be in order. To quote their policy paper, an editor may conclude that the potential harm of publication outweighs the potential societal benefits. Any scientist will tell you that's one tough call to make. Let's take the example of the microbiologist Eckhard Wimmer. He and a team of researchers actually constructed poliovirus from DNA, which they ordered from a catalog. Science magazine published their story a few months ago. Some say that sort of information provides easy ammunition for bioterrorists and say it should never have been published. Others say that we'll never get closer to new vaccines if we clamp down on the publication of just such work. Connection listeners, what do you think? Should science or should scientists take national security into account when deciding what to publish? Or is science an area where openness has to prevail? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll start today with the scientist who helped construct that poliovirus and published the results in Science. He is Eckhard Wimmer. He's a professor of molecular genetics and microbiology at State University of New York in Stony Brook. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Welcome.
I gather, Professor, that you got quite a response to this paper when it was published.
Yes, the response was overwhelming. Let me maybe explain why that might have been. What we have done is we have broken a fundamental law in biology, namely that normally you can recreate a biological entity in nature only if cells or viruses have an intact genome, an intact nucleic acid inside. And precise copies of that genome is being made in cells and in viruses, and you get offspring. Now, we have broken this law. We've sidestepped it, and we have recreated the genome and the virus simply by taking information out of the public domain and showing that you can do that as a proof of principle, and the response was overwhelming.
Now, I gather that there were politicians who saw your paper on the manufacture of poliovirus and said, this has to stop.
Yes. I think one reason that the response was so overwhelming and in part even hostile was that the paper was published a few months only after the terrible terrorist attack of September 11, 2001. And so it was immediately thought that our paper could play into the hands of bioterrorists. And so even some lawmakers thought one should take congressional action to prevent such work and, even worse, the publication of it.
So
now, as it turns out, most scientists, I think by now all scientists and even all politicians, have come to the conclusion that this work was not dangerous and it didn't endanger the American people. For once, poliovirus is an agent that, against which we are very well protected. And on the other hand, bioterrorists wouldn't go, actually, the very tedious way of synthesizing a bioterrorist agent. They would get it from nature. They would get it from laboratories, from human specimens, from clinical laboratories.
But tell me, in your view, if this policy had been in place last summer, prior to the publication of this article, do you think that it would have been published?
Yes, I think it would have been published. In fact, I think there is uniform agreement on that, and it's a meeting earlier in January at the National Academy of Sciences that was explicitly stated. And the reason is because we now know that the synthesis of polyverse does not pose a threat. It does not play at the present time into the hands of bioterrorists. In 10 or 20 years, the synthesis of a virus may become much easier because of advances in biotechnology. Then we ought to be more careful about that. For which reason, I think it's very important that we told the public at the time where it was not a danger that those things are in the future possible, and so that we can protect ourselves against misuse.
Dr. Vimmer, I want to bring another of my guests into the program now. In fact, one of the principals behind the new policy is Ron Atlas. He's president of the American Society for Microbiology. He's also editor of the journal Critical Reviews in Microbiology. Mr. Atlas, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How do you draw the line? How do you decide what could be or should be reviewed and what can go ahead?
The answer is very carefully. There is no question that, as the editors say, the openness of science needs to be protected. We need to ensure that we are not censoring the critical information that the public and the biomedical sector needs to know about. On the other hand, there may be recipes that could readily be used by terrorists to do harm, and it is explicitly that sort of information that the leading scientific publications do not want to sponsor and do not want to endorse.
Professor Atlas, is this a direct response to all the news we've been reading and hearing lately about smallpox and anthrax?
It's a direct response to the increased sense that bioterrorism is a real threat that can cause great harm. Following the anthrax attacks, the dialogue escalated quickly about the potential misuse of science. Interestingly, the questions of what scientists were communicating initially came from the press. And the press, which protects freedom of speech and the right to publish, questioned the American Society for Microbiology's publications and whether we were, in fact, endangering the public. As such, I found myself on the front line of defending science and its openness. At the same time, the American Society for Microbiology, as well as numerous other science societies, have ethical principles. Our society has a statement that says microbiologists must only work for the betterment of humankind, and we need to act to dissuade any misuse of our science. The outgrowth of the publication policy of the American Society for Microbiology, as well as the statement issued by the editors and authors that will appear this week in Science, the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, and Nature, is an outgrowth of that dialogue.
And is it important to note that it is the scientists who are doing this rather than waiting for someone from Homeland Security to say, okay, we'll be the arbiters of what can or should be published?
The argument that we've put forward is that this is a matter of ethics. It's not a matter of censorship. It's a matter of living up to our code of ethics, and therefore we as scientists need to be the judges of that. There's a great concern that government, on behalf of the public otherwise, would step in. That concern could, in fact, result in a chilling impact on science. I suspect that if the public sensed that scientists were not being ethical and responsible, there would be an outcry for censorship or constraint. As long as the scientific community continues to act ethically, I think we will be fine.
One more voice now. Patrick Brown's a professor of biology at Stanford University. He's also co-founder of the Public Library of Science. It's an online project dedicated to making these types of publications as available as possible. And Professor Brown, a matter of ethics is the way that Dr. Atlas describes it. Do you have concerns with this new policy?
Yeah, I'm concerned about it. I actually don't strongly disagree with any of the points that were made by the previous two guests, but I'm very concerned about the statement in the policy that soon, or the statement that's soon to be published, that suggests that editors should weigh the potential dangers and benefits of a work and decide not to publish a work if they feel that the dangers outweigh the benefits. And I think that that kind of rather arbitrary, intuitive decision based on prognostication of potential dangers versus benefits, I think will almost certainly, even the threat of it, will have a stifling effect on exactly the kinds of research that are most likely to help defend us against not only terrorist threats, but the much more serious and present threats from natural biological and chemical agents.
Give me an example of the sort of chill or stifling effect that you think it might have.
Oh, well, sure. For example, as both of the other guests know very well, that it's one of the considerations that every scientist has when deciding what kind of research to do is what are the prospects for that work being published in a scientific journal. If you're a graduate student, or that's what's going to determine your career prospects. And those kinds of conversations go on all the time. If I'm now contemplating doing research, let's say investigating the smallpox, the life cycle of the smallpox virus, and I know that I'm going to have real serious hurdles in publishing that work, because of course it will, anything that you learn about a potentially deadly virus not only has the potential to lead to new treatments and ways of prevention, but could provide ammunition to terrorists. Well, with all the interesting problems that you could choose to study, any additional disincentive to study a particular problem is going to reduce the likelihood.
Let me just ask Eckhard Wimmer if the policy will change the work that's done in the lab at Stony Brook.
No, it will not. As I pointed out, in fact, we're pursuing this because we found, because of the synthesis, some very interesting new genetic properties of poliovirus. I would like to just comment on what Pat Brown just said. In fact, we discussed at great length the statement that will be published, and it's been said there explicitly that if there is some work that raises a red flag, it's not necessarily so that this work will not be published, but it may be modified, the paper may be modified, which is very important. Now, here's the problem. There is a very difficult line that we must identify and not cross, because if we don't react...
Professor Wimmer, I'm sorry to have to interrupt you. We will be discussing that line as we continue our program. I want to thank you for being with us, and Connection listeners will be back after the break with more on this issue. I'm Dick. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and you'll find on the editorial page of a number of major scientific journals in America this month a statement on scientific publication and security, which says that the editors of such journals will be taking into account the danger of
certain scientific work as it might pertain to the its availability to terrorists. We have with us on the program today Patrick Brown. He's a professor of biology at Stanford University, co-founder of the Public Library of Science. Ronald Atlas is with us. He's president of the American Society for Microbiology. And Ron, I'll go back to you with the point that Pat was making just a couple of minutes ago, and that is that this sort of policy could, in fact, discourage a young scientist from getting into research for smallpox or Ebola if he or she thinks that their work can't be published.
I don't think so. I don't think we've said at all in this statement that the fundamental research which we are supporting and which will be supported with public funds and others in any way is likely to be constrained. In fact, let me go back into the statement because we've called this self-censorship. In fact, the first point that the editors make is that we're not going to allow authors to self-censor if it endangers science. At the American Society for Microbiology, we had inquiries and actually papers submitted where the authors said, the information I've produced is such that I don't want to have it all published. I'd like you to take some blackout and not publish certain information so no one can repeat it. And in fact, both the American Society for Microbiology and the editors have said that that cannot be. That would undermine science. It would whittle away at the future developments. So what we were seeing initially was concern by authors that they should not be saying things to the public or the scientific community. We've said you can't do that. The information that could raise concern among peer reviewers and editors is, I think, going to be very, very narrowly defined. It will fall into a class that I would describe as a recipe or cookbook for terrorists. And in most journals, we're never going to see that information. It would be a very, very rare occurrence. But if that were to occur, I think ethically, we should not be endorsing it and publishing it.
Patrick Brown, does that allay your concern?
Well, I guess if you're... If you said that the policy was strictly that information that has no potential value to research that will wind up protecting people against, say, natural diseases or even bioterrorist threats, but was entirely information that would give give aid to terrorists, it would be reckless to publish it, of course. And in fact, you don't need any new policies. That's the kind of information that a legitimate scientist, the kind of person who would send a paper to a scientific journal, would never try to publish in the first place. And so I don't think you need to announce a policy that gives, in a sense, license to editors to impose censorship based on potential dangers.
Okay, but be more precise for me then. What are you objecting to in this new policy?
Well, in the new policy doesn't simply say that the obvious, which is that a reputable scientific journal shouldn't recklessly publish information that has no potential does no potential good recklessly releases dangerous information. There's no need for a policy. That's always been the case. It says that editors should weigh the potential dangers versus the benefits in making publication decisions, and that is an incredibly difficult thing to do. The dangers and benefits of a scientific work are extremely difficult to recognize at the time it's published. They're usually recognized many years later because we usually can't imagine what the uses of information are. And the kinds of research that are most likely to be the most valuable in protecting us against dangers to our health are exactly the ones that are most subject to dangerous use. If I develop a way to cultivate a deadly virus, that's the first step toward developing treatments or vaccines. It's also, you could say, a cookbook for a bioterrorist who wants to grow it up and release it on a population. So the point is that it's a very delicate balance between the potential dangers and benefits, and if you raise the threat of preventing publication of things based on those potential dangers, it will just have the effect of providing of decreasing the incentive for people to pick those problems out of all the problems they could choose to investigate.
Let's get some of our callers into the conversation. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Benjamin's joining us. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi, I'm a graduate student at MIT, actually.
Yeah.
I actually have chosen at times not to do research, which out of the ethical considerations for example, military sponsors of my laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
However, and I don't see a problem with that. However, we're working on a technology in my lab, for example, which is a DNA reader, so that you can take a strand of DNA and pass it through a tiny pore and read it off. And then eventually we hope to be able to write it too. So we hope that in, you know, a few numbers of years, for $100 in your bedroom, you could make a virus of your choice, just as you can now make a computer virus. And so the technology is spreading, becoming cheaper and more widespread. And I think that top-down approaches like secrecy or bombing the nation where that bedroom is contained are
You're saying the possibility, Benjamin, let me just interrupt because I want to make sure I understand. You're saying that the possibility exists that anyone will be able to manufacture a virus in their bedroom?
Yes. The technology will lead to more widespread, cheaper availability. And
so why publish this?
Well, the thing is once people can play with such tools, once you can buy these kinds of tools, it doesn't matter whether published information is out there. You can learn about it yourself. You can explore yourself. And top-down approaches, trying to contain the information from the top down or control people from doing that is I think we need to look into the future and think about more bottom-up approaches, how to make it so that people who have this kind of intelligence and perspicacity can actually actualize themselves in more fruitful ways than by building weapons.
Ron Atlas, it has been suggested that just to have the prestigious journals impose this form of second look means that folks will just go straight to the Internet and publish it anyway. It's part of what Benjamin's saying.
The system we're proposing is not a fail-safe system. It is not going to protect against really bad actors in the field. What it says is that we in the scientific community have an ethical responsibility to live up to, and we're willing to take that on. It's not an easy task,
right,
but a necessary task.
Let's though, if we can, focus on what both Patrick and Benjamin are talking about, and that is the idea that perhaps if the information is going to be out there anyway, the whole notion of having publication as open as possible will lead scientists into the field where they will be able to, at the same time as terrorists might want to try and manufacture a virus, scientists will be manufacturing a way of preventing that virus, and that if you close down on one, you close down on the other. Professor Atlas, can you just help me on that?
I think we're going to see an enormous amount of research in biodefense. The National Institutes of Health are budgeting $1.6 billion this year for biodefense research. Some think that's excessive. It clearly is going to create an environment in which scientists move forward with their research. We're going to have a lot more of that research. And again, I just don't see taking an ethical stance of not publishing things that the editors think might be dangerous and where the benefits are not really there compared to the risks will in any way inhibit that research.
Benjamin, last word to you.
So the $100 DNA reader writer could be used to detect a virus. You know, if it was attached to a lamppost, it could be networked and it could become a security system. So we need to be able to build these technologies and share them with each other so that we can make ourselves safer.
Technology is going to move forward. I think we need to encourage that, and I don't think that the policy we're adopting in any way speaks against that.
Benjamin, just one question before you go. Tell me whether or not this statement on publication and security is getting a lot of attention in the lab.
I think that it's a little bit too new. Students do talk about very much talk about working with the military and working on weapons. In general, building a weapon or building something which can be dangerous, finding out information can be dangerous, is 90% of the work. And you can often do very valid research and just leave off that last 10% from the point of view of publishing, which would have taken you a lot of effort. So you can often in the lab, it's not such a compromise to just not do the weaponization part of the research.
All right, Benjamin, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Lexington, Massachusetts now. Gray's joining us. Hi, Gray.
Hi. This reminds me a lot of the current discussions going on in the computer world in terms of computer viruses. Security companies often jump the gun and publish details about viruses and, I'm sorry, about holes and,
right,
and ways of getting into systems, which then the script kiddies, the hackers out there, will take this information and create computer viruses. And there's this real discussion going on all levels of the computing world about how much information do we share, because it's obvious, and it happens time and time again, that security programs that are demonstrating holes are then seen to be used to hack them in the future.
This is Pat Brown. I think that analogy really doesn't quite hold with the research that gets published in the life sciences journals, because this research is intended to address threats that overwhelmingly are pre-existing natural threats from let's say natural infections, naturally dangerous exposures. It's not just a battle between the hackers and virus producers and the people who are defending against them. It's not a battle between biologists who are trying to address bioterrorism versus the terrorists. It's mostly research that is intended to protect against a much, much greater threat that we have from natural infections. You know, I'm not worried. What keeps me up at night isn't that someone's going to develop a deadlier strain of smallpox or Ebola or a more potent nerve gas than we already have or more deadly things than already exist against which we're already extremely vulnerable. We don't have any good defense. It's the pre-existing defenses that people are studying. You know, life scientists and medical researchers are basically trying to develop better ways to deal with the real threats that we face every day that kill millions of people every year without any help from terrorists. I think the analogy, if we talk about weapons research or computer hackers, is really a poor one, because it's not the good guys versus the bad guys. It's trying to develop better defenses against pre-existing threats that we face with no help from bad guys.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Gray, can I hear from you on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think right now that I think you're right right now, but I'm worried in the future that it's going to turn into the good guys and the bad guys. And yes, there's this nice component where we're worried about nature and we're worried about counteracting natural viruses. But I mean, technology is going to, you know, as we go further and further technology, I think it's going to be easier and easier for these factions to get into the business of weaponizing viruses. And I'm just worried that, okay, right now we don't have the situation where it's like in the computer world where you have the good guys and the bad guys. But what happens if we get there? And what does it mean when it's easy to pick up a journal and get, if not a cookbook, at least a lot further along the way to making something bad?
Or, Patrick, more to the point, I mean, the one thing about Gray's analogy that does seem to carry some water with me is the fact that anybody with a laptop computer and a modem now has access to information which would not have been as accessible 5-10 years ago, and maybe part of this policy is a response to that. Does that work or not?
Well, I think that I have two responses to that. Number one, I think what's limiting the ability of terrorists and any other malevolent people to do damage to people isn't scientific progress and the latest cutting edge technology. It's just imagination, opportunity, determination, using technology that already exists. I mean, 9 years ago, the tool for genocide in Rwanda was a machete. I only wish that terrorists would spend more time reading scientific journals, and instead of casing soft targets for, you know, truck bombs, we'd all be a lot safer. So I don't think that's one response. The second thing is that the best vehicle, if I wanted to distribute dangerous information, I wouldn't, the last place I'd try to do it is by publishing in a scientific journal. I mean, the irony is that you know, a bigger problem than too much access to scientific information is, in fact, that valuable scientific information that could be used to save lives is too inaccessible in the scientific journals because of restrictions on access to that information. And, you know, we're talking about information that could save lots of lives, just of people who are dying of, you know, diarrhea in the third world, as opposed to, a few hundred people that would be victims of a terrorist attack.
Okay, Ron Atlas, more openness, not less.
We have openness. We're continuing openness. The issue is, what do you do about the sort of information that Pat says would never come? In fact, it can come. It has come to scientific journals. And it's not that the author is malevolent and trying to do harm. It often is a matter of awareness as to whether or not an author has produced information that can be used to directly aid in bioterrorism. Let me take an example. Somewhere, someone has discovered how to weaponize anthrax, and we saw the application of that in the fall of 2001 with the anthrax attacks. Had that information been submitted to one of our journals, should we have published it? In essence, the statement that we issued says the editors, the peer reviewers, in conversation with the author, need to make that sort of determination. That, in fact, is what the American Society for Microbiology publishers are doing.
All right. Patrick Brown, I know you have to go, so I'll thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you for having me on your show.
Patrick Brown, professor of biology at Stanford University. Ron Atlas remains with us. Connection listeners, we're taking more of your calls after the break. 1-800-423-8255 on science and security. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about science and security. And with me on the program, Professor Ron Atlas. He teaches biology at the University of Louisville. He's co-director of the Center for Deterrence of Biowarfare and Bioterrorism at the University of Louisville. He's also president of the American Society for Microbiology. And as editor of the Critical Reviews in Microbiology, he's one of those people who has put the name of the magazine next to a statement on scientific publication and security, which says that editors may look at the potential harm of a publication outweighing the potential benefit of it when they're deciding what it is they'll publish. It's called, as I said, the Statement on Scientific Publication and Security, and you can see a copy of it on our website. It's only about a page long if you want to have a look at it. We're at theconnection.org. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Boston now, and Robin's joining us. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I can barely hear you.
Okay, I can hear you fine, so go ahead with your question.
I was wondering how you handled this type of issue during the Cold War when it felt like the threat was a lot more imminent, much closer than it does right now.
I know, Professor Atlas, that the under the nuclear label, there's a set of regulations called the Unclassified Controlled Nuclear Information, UCNI, which prevent certain bits of information and research from being released. Is this similar to what Robin's asking about?
Robin asked a very good question, and what we're doing is, in fact, different for good reasons. In nuclear research, by legislative act, the research is born classified, which means that at any point during the research, up and until the time of publication, government can step in and say, we need to classify this, you can't release it. In the life sciences, we don't have that. If we want to classify, it has to be at the inception of research. Once we get past that stage, it gets into the area of unclassified information. Now, this has happened in other fields. It's happened in mathematics and in cryptography. The cryptographers at one point agreed to a very different system. They said when you submit a manuscript, you would submit a copy to the government and a copy to the journal. And the government could then tell the journal and the author this shouldn't be published, and everyone would agree not to publish it. The difference is we're not involving the government. We're working on ethical standards within the life sciences, and therefore this really is not a government policy. Now, some in the public may feel we're not going far enough, and obviously from Pat Brown's comments, some think we're going too far, which tells me we're really right at the right place at this point in time. The other thing that happened at the height of the Cold War was National Academies of Sciences convened a panel under Dale Corson, which issued a report that stated that the benefits from fundamental research would really outweigh the benefits of trying to classify or keep secrets, and therefore, to the maximum extent possible, we should maintain the openness of science. This got formulated during the Reagan administration into National Security Decision Directive 189, which stated that principle. And even after the 9/11 events and the anthrax attacks, Condoleezza Rice reaffirmed that this is the policy of the administration. To the maximum extent possible, fundamental research must go forward with full openness.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question, and forgive me if it's at a sort of layman's level. But if a researcher figures out a way of isolating and transporting the Ebola virus and says, this is really important because we could take this virus to CDC, we could take it to the labs and finally figure out a way of getting past it. And you as the editor said, hey, you know what, this really is important. What's the risk at some point in the future the government will say, you know what, you guys have crossed the line, now we are going to review the stuff that's going in the magazines?
There is, in fact, a risk that the government on behalf of public will intervene, and it can be any government in the world. And by the way, the publisher's statement is an international statement. It's being carried in Nature, which is a British journal.
Right.
It really does involve a global response. But any government can step in at any point and clamp down. That would be a bad thing to happen. That would fall into Pat Brown's concern of having a chilling impact on the exact research we need to carry forward.
All right, Robin, thanks for your call. Next to Climax, North Carolina, Ben's joining us. Hello, Ben.
Yes, my question or statement is really that I don't understand why they're so worried about the information. They should be more worried about the education of the rest of America, because it wouldn't matter how much information is out there. It only matters is how it's being used.
Education and public information is critical in our biodefense efforts. What this statement does is simply reaffirm an ethical principle of the community.
You're saying, Ben, that someone who wants to take fertilizer and diesel fuel instead of using it on the farm to make a bomb is going to do that anyway?
That's correct, because of the morality is not inherent, it is learned. And I think that America has forgotten that not everybody has the same morality. And until we unite on our morality, the rest of this is just redundant, because anybody that decides to do this can still go and do this. And so the censorship of information is really just a backwards movement towards more control over something that you have no control over anyway.
Let me ask you something, though, Ben. I mean, they never did find the person who was behind distributing anthrax through the post office. If that person's looking for some other way of causing problems, do you think that these scientists have an obligation to make sure that he's not flipping through a magazine saying, hey, this would work?
Well, he can flip through any of Einstein's stuff and know how to bump out planets, but that doesn't mean he's able to do it. I'm saying that not only can you harm science by holding information back, because you never know who's going to come up with the miracle, whatever you need at the time, because they see it in a different way.
Right. Ron Atlas, this must gnaw at you a little bit, because it is that, I mean, you are sort of opening the door to that.
We are right on the edge. And yes, I think all of us are very fearful we could cross over into that censorship area. And we're protecting against that. It's an experiment in progress. But let me take the case of the anthrax. We have not published in any of our journals how to weaponize anthrax. I don't know that. In fact, I don't need to know that. That doesn't help advance the sort of biomedical research that we need. So the fact that that information isn't out there for copycats to fill envelopes with weaponized anthrax doesn't disturb me at all. I'm glad that's not out there. As a scientist, again, I don't need that information. If we were to cross the line of censorship to really get to the fundamental information, the sorts of things that Pat Brown expresses concern about, then I would be the first one to be yelling and saying, no, that policy is flawed. But we are not there. We have some experience this year at the American Society for Microbiology. It's causing a lot of extra work for us, but the system is working.
And you're going to look at this again in a year's time or sort of in an ongoing basis?
We're going to do this on a daily basis. This is a policy that we debate and talk about just about every day.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Ben, thanks very much for your call next to Boston, Massachusetts. And Joe's joining us. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I did my graduate work on pox viruses. And if I wanted to, I could take the publicly available sequence of smallpox, buy a strain of vaccinia virus, and get a PCR machine and probably make a good genetically amenable model of smallpox in the lab and then something that could be used as a weapon. I don't know if that's a good thing to have the smallpox sequence out there, but somebody with just a couple years of graduate school knowledge could probably turn something that's very benign into something that's very dangerous.
So what's your point, that there needs to be greater controls than are in place right now?
Well, I don't know, because it was helpful for me to have the sequence of smallpox available.
Why? What were you doing that was benefiting society?
Well, just in the model system that I was using, I can compare the gene from vaccinia virus to the genes in the smallpox virus. So it was helpful for me, but in terms of other people who weren't working on smallpox, it could have also been helpful for them. But I know there was a group that published a paper in Journal of Virology in Australia in 2001 that actually talked about putting a certain gene into a mouse pox virus that made it more dangerous and actually was able to kill animals that had been immunized. And if somebody ended up making a smallpox virus, if they put this gene in there, then maybe it would be able to kill people who are immunized against smallpox. And that's very dangerous information, I think.
Let me just ask you about the way that it's supposed to be working, Joe, because Professor Atlas is describing a world where peer review scientists and editors of scientific journals will be making judgments about, whether or not this should be published or not be published. Those are your colleagues. Is that good enough?
Yeah, I think so. As long as they are my colleagues and we can share with information with each other, but there's no way to make it foolproof that anybody with malicious intent could come in, be a scientist, then leave, and then use their knowledge for evil.
And Professor Atlas, again, we're talking not necessarily about that group of people, but the folks who would be flipping through the journal looking for something.
We are trying to protect against really that final step recipe. The fundamental sort of information, like genomic sequence information, including the smallpox virus, needs to be out there and published, because that is the basis upon which we can develop new medicinals and develop new vaccines. While I was helpful in crafting the statement from the publishers, which some are characterizing as censorship and which I characterize as responsible citizenship, I was also involved several years ago in crafting a statement that called for the publication of the smallpox genome. Mm-hmm. So openness has been something that I very much have favored protecting. But given the era we live in of bioterrorism, I think there is a certain set of information that comes very close to the weaponization sort of information that someone had to carry out the anthrax attacks, and it is really that information that I have no desire to see published and spread.
Did you yourself agonize at all over whether or not scientists ought to be doing this sort of self-policing, censorship, responsible citizenship, whatever you want to call it?
I think anyone involved in the discussions has agonized about what to do. Shortly after the anthrax attacks, I flew to New York City to talk to a colleague and begin the dialogue. We continued this within the American Society for Microbiology. We called for a meeting of the National Academies of Sciences. That meeting occurred in early January. The editors met a day later. We have continued the dialogue and continue it into the moments just before this show.
And are you happy where you are with it now, or do you think it's a little bit too restrictive, a little bit less restrictive than it ought to be?
I think we're exactly in the right place. And as I indicated earlier, the fact that it's being questioned from both sides suggests that we have hit the right balance point. It's like being on a tightrope. I'm hoping we don't get knocked off.
Professor Atlas, thanks for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Ron Atlas is president of the American Society for Microbiology and co-director of the Center for Deterrence of Biowarfare and Bioterrorism at the University of Louisville. We were joined earlier on the program by Eckhard Wimmer, professor of molecular genetics and microbiology at State University of New York at Stony Brook, and by Patrick Brown, professor of biology at Stanford University, co-founder of the Public Library of Science. That's an online project dedicated to openness. Now, Connection listeners, as I mentioned a little bit earlier on the program, you can see a copy of this statement on scientific publication and security. It's on our website. We are at theconnection.org. We'll also have a forum page there if you'd like to exchange views with other people about this subject. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugart. Our interns are Dania Akkad and Kevin Sangudi. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.